broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Where do we come from? What are we made of? These are probably two of the oldest questions asked by human beings when they first gazed at the heavens. The nitrogen in our DNA, Carl Sagan says, the calcium in our teeth, the iron in our blood, the carbon in our apple pies, were made in the interiors of collapsing stars. We are made of star stuff. If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Carl Sagan says we're made of star stuff. It sounds rather poetic, doesn't it? Are we really made from the stuff from collapsing stars? And what is star stuff anyway? Can we be more precise than stuff? To help us answer these questions, my guest today is Grant Wilson, an astrophysicist from the Astronomy Department at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Mass. Dr. Wilson is leading a team of astronomers in building the next generation millimeter wavelength polarimetric camera for studying the heavens. The camera will be used to conduct surveys in star formation and galaxy evolution. In the spirit of full disclosure, I'll also let you know that Grant Wilson is my son. Grant, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Grant, Carl Sagan says we're made of star stuff. Is he right? And what is star stuff?
I can attest Carl was correct when he said that. So, we're made of star stuff. And in fact, not only us, but take a look around you. Everything you see here on Earth, including the Earth itself, including everything else you see in the universe right now, is made of star stuff. Stars are, this is my own factory model for the universe. Stars are factories, and stars are factories that take the raw materials of hydrogen gas and transform it through this process called nucleosynthesis, the actual making of nucleons, into more and more interesting stuff. Hydrogen's about the most simple thing that we have in the universe. And stars, over the course of the last 13.7 billion years as the universe has been around, stars have been continually generating new and more interesting elements out of hydrogen gas.
Is it only collapsing stars, or where does this dust come? Dust, I call it dust because you and I've talked, and you mention it as dust. Is dust a term of art for the stuff?
Yeah, dust, interstellar dust, the kind of dust that we study and observe with the cameras I build, is actually just a fancy term for complex conglomerations of carbon and silicon. You'll recognize both of those elements as being extremely abundant here on Earth. And they're the byproducts of stellar evolution. So when stars go through their lives, at the end stages of their lives, they start creating carbon and silicon. And then at the very end of their life, all stars will give up back to the galaxy, back to the cosmos, huge amounts of carbon and silicon in the form of this dust.
Well, you're studying this dust at UMass, right? And other places. You're developing a camera that is a millimeter wavelength camera. Now, I've got a camera in my cell phone. And as a photographer at one time, I've had a number of different kinds of cameras. They've all had lenses and optics. What's a millimeter wavelength camera, and how is it different from the camera in my iPhone?
Yeah, so the human eye, excuse me, the human eye is sensitive to what we call optical light. So optical light has a wavelength of, which is just a measure of distance in the light itself, a wavelength of about a tenth of a micron, which imagine a millimeter, something pretty small. If you hold your fingers just a little bit apart, that's about a millimeter. And now try to imagine something about 1/10,000th that size. And that's the size of a typical photon of optical light. And so optical cameras can be quite small, literally because the light is so small. And so if you imagine the camera in your phone, you can have millions of pixels, little tiny things that you make based on silicon, again, coming from stars. Whereas millimeter wavelength light, this light is much larger, 10,000 times bigger. And as a result, the detectors themselves have to be about 10,000 times bigger. So now you're talking about things you can actually look at and see with your naked eye, and that need to be on order of a millimeter in size or larger in order to detect millimeter wavelength light.
Well, if imagine you've got a yardstick, for instance, place a millimeter wavelength of light on that yardstick. Give me some context here. What right. are we dealing with?
Okay, so if we imagine a yardstick representing the entire set of light in the universe, the entire electromagnetic spectrum, on one end of the yardstick would be very, very long wavelengths, things we call radio waves. They stretch from hundreds of miles to down to 10 centimeters or so is what typical astronomers think of as radio waves. Then next to that, you have the millimeter wavelength light, which gets a little bit shorter. And then we move to the middle of the yardstick or around there where you have the infrared, then into the optical part of the spectrum, going all the way from the reds all the way up to the blues, and then finally into the ultraviolets. Beyond that, you're getting to extremely short wavelength light, ultraviolet, X-rays, and then gamma rays. So the millimeter wavelength light, compared to the optical light, is low energy, long wavelength, and very abundant in our universe. In fact, our universe is just filled with millimeter wavelength light.
And you're putting together a camera that looks at this light. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's right. So for thousands of years, humans have been doing astronomy with really entirely using optical light, either by looking with their eyes or following the birth of the telescope and the use of the telescope with Galileo all the way up until the beginning of the 1900s. Just looking at it with optical telescopes. Well, the last century has seen the development of new kinds of detectors that could detect X-rays, radio waves, ultraviolet radiation. All of this is just light of different flavors or different colors, if you will. And since the 60s, we've started getting better and better at building detectors that could actually measure millimeter wavelength light. And millimeter wavelength light is interesting because, again, it pervades the universe because dust pervades the universe, this byproduct of the formation of stars. So dust glows and emits millimeter wavelength light all throughout the universe. You can find dust in comets. You can find dust in around stars, around embedded in all around galaxies, and even on larger spatial scales in the universe.
So you're going to look at this dust. You've already developed a camera called Aztec, and that was designed to look at millimeter length light too. And where do you put this camera, Grant?
The story of Aztec is kind of fun because we were back in the very beginning of the 2000s. We started with the idea of putting together this camera called Aztec in order to measure the dust in our universe. And we were really following on what to then had been one of the biggest millimeter wavelength cameras ever built by humans, called SCUBA, which made groundbreaking discoveries at the end of the 1990s. And we, by working with people from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, we were able to envision a camera with an astounding, at the time, astoundingly large set of detectors. We thought we could do as many as 140 detectors in this camera. Now, just 5 years later, I had done my my PhD, or about 3 years later, I had done my PhD based on what was then an astoundingly sensitive and large millimeter wavelength camera that had 6 detectors. You can start to see the progression here. As we, as humans, got better and better at making these kinds of detectors, the numbers of detectors in our cameras slowly grew. And we thought, well, let's go for 140 detectors. And we pulled that off. And by 2005, built a camera called Aztec that didn't have a home, but we brought it to a telescope called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope on the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. And from there, acting as a guest instrument at that telescope, we were able to make a handful of really groundbreaking new observations of the universe and of the dust in our universe using this new tool.
So what were you seeing out there? No, let me ask it another way. With Aztec, when you did the first observations on the mountain in Hawaii, what surprised you at what you saw?
Yeah, the neat thing of what we got out of those observations, and I got to tell the truth, it took us about 2 years to publish the first papers from these observations. It's a long process to dig the interesting signals out of the noise of the data from these kinds of observations. And we can talk about what's hard about that later, I hope. But what we found once we finally cleaned up all the observations and made the very best images is we found a huge assortment of galaxies in the universe, things at the time we called submillimeter galaxies. Now we called them dust-enshrouded star-forming galaxies to get more at the physics of what's actually going on inside of them. And while we didn't discover these galaxies, we were the first camera to measure large numbers of them and be able to measure them in such a way that people were able to go back with even more sensitive telescopes that couldn't do the kinds of observations we could do, but who could focus in on the actual galaxies we had found and study them even further in great detail. And so it was the discovery of these, the numbers, the raw numbers of these galaxies was the thing that surprised us.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on when we talk about the telescope that you're currently working on. Will kind of be the second generation of Aztec. And I think it's interesting that you chose to put the camera after Hawaii. The telescope in Mexico was completed, and you put Aztec on me. Why Mexico? What is going on with Mexico? Mexico is not, for those of us not in the in the world of millimeter wavelength polarimetric telescopes. What is Mexico's history that has led you to put this to build this telescope in Mexico and put and put Aztec, we'll call it, on the telescope in Mexico.
Right. We normally don't think of Mexico as leading in scientific discovery and opening up new opportunities, but this was actually a case where the Mexican government, led really by a very very visionary astronomer there named Alfonso Serrano, decided that by teaming up with the University of Massachusetts, they could build a telescope in Mexico and help fund a telescope in Mexico that would be really transformative for the study of millimeter wavelength astronomy. And frankly, the people in Mexico and the people at UMass at the time, and this was around the mid-90s, honestly didn't understand exactly the revolution in millimeter astronomy that they were preparing to open up. They had other ideas, but as good ideas happen, they evolve. And so in the mid-90s, people started teaming up and said, let's see if we can build not a normal millimeter wavelength telescope, but an extremely large single-dish telescope that would be wonderful for surveying the sky very rapidly and seeing and really looking at areas hundreds of times as large as the full moon. Whereas what had been done in the past, the entire history of millimeter astronomy in the past had been confined to an area of maybe a tenth the size of the full moon. So we're really talking about opening up an entirely new view on the sky and of the universe at millimeter wavelengths.
But Mexico isn't new to astronomy. The Aztecs developed fantastic calendars and information about the movement of the stars and so forth.
That's right. The Aztecs had astronomy like all agrarian cultures. The Aztecs knew that astronomy was important, mostly to tell time. Mexico continued with their interest in astronomy through construction of a series of small optical telescopes that people use. There's a lot of interesting stories of Mexican astronomers in the 1900s who came to the United States, studied with the great astronomers at the time, and then returned to Mexico and continued to build a small but very vibrant community. And that's what put them in the position of being able to finally go to the Mexican government and make agreements with UMass about really taking on what ended up being the largest scientific project in the history of Mexico, which was the construction of this telescope called the Large Millimeter Telescope.
The LMT, I guess.
That's right.
To use the initials, but this telescope is on top of a mountain in Mexico. Tell us a bit about, and where we're going here is the camera that you're working on is going to be placed in this telescope. It will take the place of the earlier telescope that you put there.
Yeah. So to tie that story up a little bit about this camera Aztec. So. We had built this camera with about 140 detectors inside of it, and we had brought it to really the state-of-the-art millimeter wavelength telescope at the time called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. And that's a 15-meter diameter telescope. So what's that, about 45 feet or so across. Now, the power of a telescope comes down to the size of that first big mirror. So the bigger the mirror, the more sensitive your observations will be, and the finer the resolution you'll have on the sky to be able to tell one thing apart from another thing. So 15 meters was fantastic. The Large Millimeter Telescope is 50 meters in comparison, which makes it, about 10 times or a little more than that times more powerful than the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. So bringing Aztec to the telescope in Hawaii gave us the chance to try out the camera, work out the bugs, really learn how the camera works, and then in preparation for eventually bringing it to the Large Millimeter Telescope once that was finished. So now I've already forgotten the question you asked me. So.
Well,
But getting back to
what I was getting at was the site.
Yes,
you put it on top of Mexicans put it on top of this mountain.
Yeah, that was actually so. This was not just the Mexicans, but people at UMass who worked closely with our Mexican colleagues. And this was back a while before I joined the project. But everyone recognized at the time that the atmosphere, and specifically the water in the atmosphere, both absorbs millimeter wavelength light and emits it itself. And so imagine trying to do an observation of the sky where if you have a cloud come over, you lose all of your signal. And not only that, the cloud itself acts like a big spotlight beaming down into your telescope, corrupting your signals even more. So people knew at the time that in order to get above most of the atmosphere, you have to go to a large mountaintop and get up as high as you can, or the alternative is to go to the South Pole, where it's so cold that most of the water has precipitated out of the atmosphere by the time it gets there. And so, again, the South Pole is one of the driest deserts on Earth.
Where I believe you've been, making a balloon observations in your graduate student days.
Yeah, that was actually the coast of Antarctica. I never made it all the way to the pole, but I've gotten pretty close. In the United States, there's actually some peaks, but they're not particularly high. If you want to go to some of the driest places in the United States, you go to Hawaii and go to the summit of Mauna Kea, where there are a number of telescopes. A number of people are now going to Chile and go to the Atacama Desert, which has both the benefits of being a desert and being having very high peaks where you can place telescopes. In our case, the original ideas for our telescope were to put them in Massachusetts, which honestly, in retrospect, is a horrible place for a millimeter wavelength telescope because it's not particularly dry, but it is convenient if you're at UMass. When our Mexican colleagues joined the project, they said, well, look, we've got a bunch of mountaintops in Mexico. Why don't we go test different mountaintops? We can put a device on a number of different mountaintops called a water vapor radiometer. That's a fancy word for a machine that just looks up and measures how much water do you see in the sky above you. And we'll see if any of them are good. It turns out a lot of them were very good. Then once we decide, or once a nice set of sites were found, we started narrowing them down, and eventually the site for the LMT was chosen. I should add, before the site of the telescope was chosen, a different mountaintop was favored. It was a nice drive from the city of Puebla, which is a colonial city in Mexico that's absolutely beautiful. It's about 3 million people in Puebla, and it's a very convenient drive from the institute that is our sister institute in Mexico called the INAOE, the Instituto Nacional de Astrofísica Óptica y Electrónica, and we call it INAOE for short. They put a water vapor radiometer to measure the water above this particular mountaintop on top of the mountain, and boy, they got fantastic results. It was dry. It was beautiful. Now, the only problem was that while the water vapor radiometer was up there, it was extremely dry and extremely beautiful. And the village down below the mountain suffered one of the worst droughts during that period that they had suffered before. And at some point, some people in the village got the idea that it was actually the water vapor radiometer that was causing the drought. They went up, threw the water vapor radiometer off the side of the mountain, and dang if it didn't rain the next day. And so,
well, they were right.
We knew after then we would never be able to put the telescope on top of that particular mountain. No. And so we chose a different one.
So is Sierra Negra, is that the mountain?
Yeah, it's an extinct volcano called Sierra Negra. It is actually on the ridge line that is the edge of the plateau that Mexico City and Puebla sit on, just before the plateau drops off and goes down to Veracruz and meets the Gulf of Mexico back at sea level. So we're actually at on a mountaintop that Cortez and his armies walked right past as they were moving in to invade Mexico a long time ago.
I guess. Well, you're working on a new generation of camera now to take the place of Aztec. And what is this one called? And why are you creating a new generation camera? And when do you expect it to be done and placed on the LMT?
Right. So this camera is called Toltec. So we're sort of making our, as we build new cameras, we're honoring the more ancient civilizations in Mexico. Aztec isn't an acronym, though some people think it is. And Toltec's not an acronym, though some people think it is. Though we feel very strongly that the culture in Mexico is a deep part of the telescope itself and how we talk about telescope, how we do astronomy in Mexico. And we continue to want to honor this culture through a simple thing as naming of the instrument. Turns out to be a big thing because that's being the largest science project in Mexico. The project gets a lot of press, and so people end up saying these names a lot. And I think they're I've seen firsthand that there really is a lot of pride in the fact that we're doing all this work. So Toltec is, as you said, the follow-on instrument to Aztec. It's been now 13 years since we completed the Aztec instrument, and during that time, there's been an enormous amount of continued work on millimeter wavelength detectors. And the reason for that is primarily because it's also millimeter wavelength detectors can be used to measure this radiation called the cosmic microwave background radiation. And the cosmic microwave background emanates from a time pretty shortly after the Big Bang, about 400,000 years after the Big Bang.
The Big Bang, Grant, the beginning of the universe, to give us a perspective on time here, that's about 13.7 billion years ago. Is that what we're looking
at? That's right, 13.7 billion years. And so 400,000 years is just a tiny, tiny bit of time after that in an astronomical sense or cosmological sense. The cosmic microwave background, because it comes from such an early time in the universe's history, is rife with information about what the universe was like back then. And we can learn very fundamental things, such as the age of the universe, such as how much stuff in the universe is like us, as opposed to like other, or as opposed to completely mysterious, like dark matter and dark energy. And while I don't study those things directly, I do study the astrophysics I do, which is all about stars and galaxies, is at the same wavelengths as those kinds of studies. And so we're able to use the technology that's developed for the cosmic microwave background work instead of on cosmic microwave background, instead on astrophysics. So in the 13 years since we built Aztec, people have been working on different detector technologies. In fact, they're fundamentally different detector technologies. Our detectors that we're working with now look nothing like the Aztec detectors and have enabled us to imagine and, in fact, now build cameras that don't have 100-ish detectors, but instead have up to 10,000-ish detectors. So there's a fundamental change in how many detectors we can field in a camera, which means which comes down to how fast we can actually image the sky. And so the new camera we're working on now, called Toltec, actually has 7,000 detectors and three, and not only so many more detectors, but 7,000 detectors in three different colors, three different parts of the millimeter spectrum, and will allow us to image the sky something like 50 to 100 times faster than we can image it with Aztec. And so a project that currently takes 2 months to do on the LMT with Aztec, we'll be able to do in a single night with the new instrument.
And that translates also into economics, doesn't it? Into cost.
It does, because there's a number of things going on. First, it costs money to run the LMT each night, so you want to be able to maximize the science that you can do with every hour of observing. Certainly, we'll be able to do that with the new instrument. It's also the case that even though we're up on a mountaintop, there is still residual atmosphere above us, of course, and still a little bit of water above us. And that little bit of water that is above us is still about 1,000 times brighter than any source we're trying to look at. And so the faster we can get through our observations, the faster we can do things without the atmosphere above us changing, the more likely we're going to get an uncorrupted set of data out of the out of the telescope.
Well, you're building this thing at the University of Massachusetts, but I understand you have a lot of partners associated with the construction of this camera, which you had mentioned to me in other conversations that is going to be about as big as a Volkswagen. Who are your partners, and what are the tasks that go into building this telescope?
Right. So I have a funny job as an astronomer, because I build cameras as an astronomer. We've gone from the point where back when I was a graduate student, again, with the smaller cameras, we could do that with pretty much one or two groups of collaborating institutions could get together and do this. We're now at the point where we have groups from three different countries, and I think it's seven different institutions actively working now on different parts of the camera, of Toltec. And so who do we have? We have Arizona State University, a group there led by Professor Phil Mauskopf, is building all of the electronics to read out our detectors. Our detectors themselves are being built at a federal institution, the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado, led by Jay Osterman, who is actually a former graduate student of mine. We have another group at Wisconsin, and another group at Michigan, and another group at Northwestern University, building just different parts of the instrument that will eventually go together. Some are doing optics, some are doing electronics, some are doing mechanical pieces that will all come together. And then we round that off with groups at Inaue, our sister institution in Mexico, is doing all of the work actually at the telescope to get ready for this, as you said, a sort of VW bus size instrument that will be installed at the telescope. And then yet another group at University of Cardiff in Wales, who does all of our optical filtering. And they're the world's experts at this. At UMass, we focus on the big body of the instrument itself, which is a big something called a cryostat. It's a big network of refrigerators and vacuumed out chambers that house the detectors and the optics for the camera.
Because things have to be cold, right?
Things have to be, yeah, these detectors have to be extremely cold. They are so sensitive. Here's a calculation I did a long, long time ago. These detectors, once you place them on the LMT, are so sensitive that if you could take a standard microwave oven, which even though it's generating microwaves to warm your food, actually does bleed into the millimeter part of the spectrum a little bit. You take a standard microwave oven and bring it to the moon and turn it on with the door shut, that would be a blindingly bright signal to our camera. So these are incredibly sensitive detectors. The way you get them to be so sensitive and actually to enable their detecting capabilities, you have to get them extremely cold, in our case, about 0.1 degrees above absolute zero is what we're aiming for. So that's the Kelvin scale, 0.1 Kelvin. And I'll tell you, you look at the camera, if you were to take all the pieces that are actually doing anything with the light, they would fit on a standard dining room table. But you need something the size of a VW bus to cool that dining room table down to just 0.1 degrees above absolute zero and get everything cold that needs to be cold.
And you're going to assemble all of the pieces from these various partners at the University of Massachusetts?
Yeah, the way this has been going on, we've been working on this for a little more than 2 years now in the actual building phase. And each institution builds its own parts. So, for example, the detectors are being built at NIST in Boulder, Colorado, and they're being built there. And then some rudimentary tests, because they don't have test setups big enough to do all the tests that we want to ultimately do with the detectors. But they do it all there. And then when they're finally done, which is in the coming month, in fact, all of the detectors get shipped to UMass, where everything is integrated together in the camera package. And only after everything arrives at UMass, all the tests are done on the camera, finally as a camera, instead of as individual parts, will we then take it all back apart again, put it in a big shipping container, ship it down to Mexico, and then go through the process of reassembling it. But this time, instead of the comfort of our lab, at 15,000 feet altitude on a mountaintop.
Grant, I find it very interesting that you are using students at the University of Massachusetts to work on the construction of this camera, Toltec. How do you find working with students in this process?
Well, I actually love working with students. And I'm very proud of the work we're doing with students, because as I was saying, the astronomical instrumentation, the kind that's going on cameras around the world, is only becoming more and more expensive and more complicated to build. And so it's getting more and more difficult to find funding to build these big things, and frankly, to find people who have the capabilities to build these big things. Most astronomers, I would say 95% of them, have never been in a lab. They download their data from some telescope's archive, and then they do complex analyses on the data they've downloaded. In our case, we're actually working with our hands. We're working with machinists. We're designing things. We're being mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, cryogenic engineers, and doing things really across the board. And so it requires the development of a very wide range of skills, and not necessarily the skills that would serve a student who wanted to go and download images and analyze them from the Hubble Space Telescope. That's a different skill set. We bring students into the lab who express an interest in working with their hands and actually getting involved. And I think of us as certainly not unique, but getting to be more and more rare, because the big instruments are more and more being built by big engineering firms, Northrop Grumman and Ball Aerospace and places like that. So we have the opportunity to bring students in at a relatively young age. We bring them in as sophomores or juniors because we know that they need time to learn skills in the lab before they're going to get useful. And then over time, they pick up these skills until by the time they're seniors, they are at the point where they're incredibly valuable, and then they graduate and leave the lab. And we have to deal with the loss of that student now. But that's the painful part. The wonderful part is seeing the development of these kids as they get the skills and start to make real meaningful contributions to the instrument.
But that's one of the reasons, isn't it, that UMass can own this camera, and one of the justifications for your funding to build the camera, isn't it, the kind of teaching methodology that you're using in the construction of Toltec?
Yeah. So as a public educational institution, we take as part of our mission the education of young students. And so I wouldn't do it any other way. We could have hired technicians to come into the lab and professional engineers and done it that way. But we prefer this model where we actually train the people who will be the future engineers. It's not the most efficient way of doing things. I'll be very clear about that. It may not be the most expensive, because these students don't cost a lot of money to give them these wonderful research opportunities. But it is certainly not the most efficient, because we have to do the training of the students has when they come into the lab. And it takes a while. I should also note that one big emphasis we put, we pushed this in the original proposal when we wrote to the U.S. government for money to do this camera. We said we were going to try to train as many female students as we could in instrumentation, because historically there's been a lack of female participation in actually the engineering side and the building side. And I'm really proud to say that we've put women in leadership positions in the project. Our project scientists, two of them are both women. We've hired female graduate students, female undergraduates, and it's been a real pleasure to see their development and actually see the cultural shift that's come in the lab by having it be dominated by female students rather than male students. It's been a lot of fun to see.
Well, this sounds like a fantastic side benefit of building this camera, the teaching that you're doing. You mentioned the Hubble. Almost everyone is familiar with the Hubble because of the images and the publicity that the Hubble gets. How is this camera and this, and when it's all installed, how will this the LMT with Toltec install be different from the Hubble?
Right. So the Hubble is an optical telescope. And you're right, the Hubble images, which everyone can look at by just going online, are absolutely breathtaking. And I'll challenge you to go find a Hubble image that at some point you don't see dark bands of dust in. And as I was saying before, the dust just pervades the universe. And one of the things that that was discovered in the late 90s with this original millimeter wavelength camera called SCUBA was that there are galaxies, and not just a few of them, as we later showed with Aztec, but enormous numbers of them, galaxies that have produced so much dust as their stars have been born and gone through their life cycle and died, and the next generation of stars produces yet more dust and so on as the generations go on. There are galaxies that are completely enveloped in dust, to the point where our Hubble telescope, the most powerful telescope we have in space, cannot see them at all. It is a black shell of dust around, completely enveloping the galaxies. And what's interesting about that is that those galaxies that Hubble can't see, or at least some of them, are the dust around them is being heated by the starlight inside of the galaxy. And so the dust warms up to a whopping temperature of around 30 to 40 degrees above absolute zero. It was still pretty cold stuff, but warm enough that the dust will then emit millimeter wavelength radiation. So we have examples, and not just a few, but many examples from our Aztec work, where we can see some of the brightest galaxies in the sky at millimeter wavelengths. These are some of the most massive galaxies in the universe, and galaxies that are producing new stars at anywhere from a few hundred to several thousand new stars every year. Well, let me put that in context. Our Milky Way, the galaxy we live in right now, produces about one to two new stars every year. But these galaxies we find often in the very early universe are producing several hundred to a few thousand new stars every year, and they are some of the most massive galaxies in the universe. You can look at the Aztec image, and by far it's the brightest thing in the image. You go to the same part of the sky and look at it with Hubble, and you see absolutely nothing. So completely hidden from view. And in fact, the discovery of this galaxy population in the late 90s by the SCUBA instrument was one of the bigger discoveries of that epoch. We now know that the universe is littered with, and some of the most massive galaxies are just completely dust obscured. So if we're going to have a full accounting of galaxies in our universe where we live, we need to both have detailed imagery at optical wavelengths with Hubble and later with JWST in a few years, as well as a complete accounting in the radio and then at millimeter wavelengths where we can see the dust.
Grant, you're looking at these early galaxies on now 100 million years from the Big Bang, perhaps, and you can correct my numbers in a minute. Are we looking at something that is dead now? When you look at the light from these early galaxies, are they? It takes so long for the light to get here. Are they still about?
So let me fix one of the numbers, and maybe I can give a little cosmic timeline as well. So we know the universe is about 13.7 billion years old. We actually, just from a discovery by the EDGES experiment earlier this in 2018, we now know that the first stars in the universe formed somewhere around 180 million years after the Big Bang. Those were the first stars. When the first galaxies formed, we actually don't know yet. We've seen galaxies a billion years after the Big Bang, maybe 500 million years after the Big Bang. We're still working that out. And I think the new James Webb Space Telescope that'll launch in just a few years should clean that up. You know, we'll see the first galaxies in their active formation with James Webb. The galaxies that we see, we now see with Aztec and we'll later see with Toltec, actually span the entire, we can see galaxies through the entire history of the universe. So yes, we will be able to see the galaxies as soon as they have enough dust, because that's the thing we're sensitive to, we'll be able to see them. And we'll be able to see dusty galaxies all the way back to the present day. And then we'll start looking, once we get into the nearby universe, we can even look into our own galaxy and watch star formation going on through the dust with Toltec as well. But to get back to your question, those early galaxies, they don't dissipate. They are gravitationally held together. The kinds of things that can happen to them are they can collide with another galaxy and merge and become a bigger galaxy. That's quite common. They can absorb more hydrogen gas. Hydrogen gas was produced in the Big Bang. And so there is plenty of fuel out there in the universe. A galaxy that's on its own, we now understand, is pretty much being constantly fed with new fuel supply from the cosmos in the form of hydrogen gas, that the galaxy, again acting as a factory, will turn into stars. And so galaxies evolve by absorbing that hydrogen gas, making new stars, colliding with other galaxies, making bigger galaxies. Sometimes you see them and they look like a mess. We call those train wrecks. Sometimes they form, when left on their own, they'll form beautiful spiral patterns. And you'll see, just like we think the Milky Way looks, you'll see these beautiful, what we call grand design spirals. Sometimes you can find galaxies where they're in an environment that's cut off the fuel supply. We actually, that's an open question in astronomy, is exactly how that happens. And then those galaxies actually use up all of their fuel, and their stars just go through their lives, no new stars being formed, but their stars, they are filled with stars that will last anywhere from 10 to tens to hundreds of billions of years. And they just slowly fade away. We call those galaxies old, red, and dead. But there's actually, if you pour new fuel into them, there's no reason to think they wouldn't start forming new stars as well.
Grant, the other kind of telescopes that I've read about are these array telescopes, like down in Chile. They have a bunch of telescopes looking at the heavens there. And I don't know if they're radio telescopes or really what they are, but what will be the relationship between the LMT and these array telescopes?
Right. So we were talking about before about how the size of the telescope definitely matters. The bigger the telescope you can build, the better off you are. And the LMT will be the largest millimeter wavelength single dish telescope at 50 meters. Now, that said, there is a much, much more powerful telescope, now telescope in quotes, because it's an array of telescopes, called ALMA, which is a set of 50 16-meter telescopes. We think of that as a small telescope, even though you stand next to it, these things are gigantic. But a set of 50 of these, this is a $1.5 billion project taken on by Japan, Europe, and the United States, and Chile. And those 50 telescopes can be spread out very, very widely and over the course of many kilometers diameter area, and they can synthesize the effective aperture of a much, much larger telescope. And that's an incredibly powerful technique called interferometry that can be used to make an unbelievably large telescope that is extremely sensitive. And ALMA is wonderful at that. And then ALMA works at millimeter wavelengths, just like the LMT. Now, you might ask, well, given ALMA, why do you go and build something that's 50 meters in size? The big difference is that there's a couple big differences. One is ALMA can spread out and have incredible resolution, 10 times, 100 times better than the LMT. But they can only image a very, very small part of the sky at any one time. So I think of the LMT with its big array camera as being something that can quickly image large areas of the sky and really probe out the physical environment of the universe, of various processes in the universe, whether it's the entire universe or whether it's large sections of our own galaxy, where you can see the environment that's leading to what's going on at much smaller scales. ALMA can't do the big environmental part, but they can then focus in on the most interesting areas and focus their very expensive and very valuable time interrogating small detailed patches of sky with orders of magnitude better sensitivity than we could with the LMT. But we set the big picture, and we're able to set the big picture. That's one of the big differences. Getting back to the student training and just teaching people how to build astronomical instrumentation, with the LMT, we only build one camera, and then we with thousands of detectors, and then we put that one camera inside the LMT. If you want to put a new camera on ALMA, you have to build 50 of them. And you couldn't get me to build 50 of anything. It's, building one is hard enough. Building 50, that requires a factory, and that's a different kind of work that you can't really apply student-driven labs to.
Well, I want to ask you also, why is it important that we know this?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. And of course, there's many different answers to this.
Oh, I'm sure. Of course.
I think the most direct answer is that we as humans now are building an understanding of both the past and projecting off into the future of our universe. And I think it's critical that we understand how we got here in an existential sense. It's critical that we have a model that can predict where we're going off into the future. And it's just cool that you look up and you don't have to wonder what those points of lights are. You don't have to wonder what those globs of lights for that are actually galaxies are making. You can understand this at a very fundamental level. And what's one of my favorite things is that you can then take all the laws of physics that we understand, and really this is very relatively simple physics compared to some that's going on Earth. But you can take those laws of physics and you can program them right into a computer, and then you can simulate your own universe. And you can simulate it with pretty astounding accuracy compared to our own universe now. And that's only getting better and better as time goes on. So we build a predictive model, and we understand what's out there. We understand where we've come from, and we understand both how alone we are and how maybe vital we are. One of the things I like to think about is we don't know whether there are other conscious creatures in the universe. We know we've got plenty of them here on Earth. We don't know how many there are elsewhere in the universe? The answer could very well be zero, besides on Earth. We don't know, because we have no evidence for that yet. What a waste of space the universe would be if we didn't look up and appreciate it. What if there's no one else out there to appreciate what's going on across 13 billion light years of space? That's just the part we can see in each direction. We're able to be here and appreciate this universe at a conscious level, perhaps uniquely. And so I think it's our duty to spend time looking up and understanding our universe, as well as understanding the Earth here, our home here as well.
And to go back to what we started with, it is also what we're made of, and what everything is made of. Now, what's next for you, Grant? You're going to build this big camera. You're going to build this big camera, and you'll enjoy putting it on the LMT, and you'll enjoy the first images that begin to come, or the first data that you begin to receive, and you'll enjoy watching people analyze that data and come up with new ideas about the universe. And then what are you going to work on?
Yeah,
what's next for you?
That's a great question. And I always say that's a great question when I don't quite know the answer yet. Toltec is all consuming, as big projects tend to be. I'll tell you this. A number of times with Aztec, we were able to analyze the data and have an image pop up on the screen and then take a deep breath as we saw the image, almost a gasp, and wonder, wow, we're the first people to ever see this part of the universe in this way and to see this effect. So I'm at the moment really focused on recreating that scenario many, many times over with our Toltec imagery, and trying to give back to the community through scientific papers and more understanding of the universe. So after that, I don't know. I'm getting old. I'm 49 already. I don't know if I have another big project in me like this. It takes a lot out of you. But I'll certainly be helping my students to lead their projects and do the next big thing, Grant, afterwards.
Grant, thank you very much for joining us on Delmarva today. Writer's Edition. Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. So we actually are made of stardust or stardust. So Toltec will actually take us for a walk further back in time to look at actually where we came from. Thank you again, Grant.
Thank you, and happy holidays to you.
Thank you, and thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.